call on the ice stands. We gotta go.
Okay, fellas, we are set to go.
Let's roll, boys. Come on, let's get going.
We are kicking.
Here we go.
Both guys, 5 minutes each for fighting.
Watch the blue.
Play the puck.
We're not doing this.
Hey. After further review, it's the Scouting the Refs podcast.
Yeah, baby.
Here's your hosts, Todd Lewis and Josh Smith.
Okay, gentlemen, play ball. Let's go.
All right, guys, let's drop the puck.
Hey, we're into the Stanley Cup playoffs. It's our favorite time of year. Josh, it occurs to me, and I meant to ask you about this before the postseason games got started, but I'll do it now because we're still in the very early stages. Some players are continuing on with this tradition, and it'll look spectacular as we move through the postseason. But I didn't know what any rules or official regulations were in terms of playoff beards for officials.
You know, I don't know that there's anything official or anything formal for that, but I think it would be a great opportunity for the officials to do it. But I think they need their own thing. I think we're used to seeing the players with the playoff beards. I think we need to take a page out of Bill McCreary's book, and I think the officials need to go for the playoff mustache. I think I want to see the stripes with the big, let's let it go. Let's see how it comes in. And when we get to the Stanley Cup final, I want these big Bill McCreary mustachioed officials out there. I think that's the way to go. I want the refs and linesmen to have playoff mustaches.
Okay. Yeah. Something, just some sort of acknowledgement. I like that idea. I can get on side with that. This is the Scouting the Refs podcast, by the way. Please make sure you follow the social channels. You'll find Josh at Scouting the Refs on X and Instagram. I'm at Todd Lewis Sports on X and Instagram as well. On this week's episode, big hits. Which ones are penalties? Who can count to five? Ref down, and we'll call it the triple doink for the for the shot that went back and forth. So, okay, before we go too far, though, I want to take a moment because I grew up with this as the soundtrack of Saturday nights, and we sent our sympathies and strength to the millions of fans of Bob Cole, who was the voice of Hockey Night in Canada for 50 years. If you were a Canadian and you think back to a dramatic moment in hockey over the last 50 years, you undoubtedly are hearing Bob Cole's voice in your head calling the action. It was spectacular. We're sad that he has left us, but we are richer for having experienced his call on so many occasions.
Absolutely. And even as somebody growing up in the States where you didn't get the Canadian broadcasts, I mean, so much is shared online, so much is on social media, so many of even the video packages that were put together, you can't have been a hockey fan and not knowing Bob Cole. So yeah, really sad to hear of his passing, but what a figure in hockey history.
Unquestionable. Yes, there are some great tributes as well. Elliot Friedman wrote a terrific one on sportsnet.ca, and that's just one of many that have been posted as well. We did have, and we talk about this during the playoffs often on a regular basis, but it happened very quickly. We had our first replacement ref in the postseason in the Jets and Avalanche game. Trevor Hansen left the game, but that's all right. We just make the call to the bullpen, and Michael Markovic comes in to take over.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, people get excited for the emergency backup goalie. You can't help but get excited for the emergency backup official, too. And obviously, in the playoffs, we do have set officials. There are guys assigned to each game. Every single game gets at least one official on standby in the building to step in if there's anything that happens. If it was a lines person, Markovic might have been playing the lines there. He might have been manning it that way and working his first time as a linesman in the playoffs. But you want to have the backup officials. They're ready. They're waiting there. I mean, we've talked to a few guys who've been in that spot. You're in the officials room with everything on but your skates. You're ready to jump into action. And that's what they do. And they get paid to be there. They get paid more if they step on the ice. So Markovic's picking up $2,750 for his one night of work on the ice. And he gets to work a playoff game. So a pretty exciting moment. I mean, obviously, you hope that the officials, in this case, Trevor Hansen's okay. But nice to see, with the importance of the games and the significance of every game that's happening, that the NHL makes it a point that we have standby officials. We're not going with the three-man crew. We do it in the regular season. There's no standby official in the regular season. But during the playoffs, we'll get at least one guy there. And then as we get to the conference finals and the cup final, we'll have a referee and linesman on staff to hop in should it be needed. But that's why they're there. And, you know, for Markovic, you never want to see a guy get injured. You'd never want to have an injury prompt your playoff debut, but you know, good for him for acquitting himself nicely on the ice there, called it just fine the rest of the game. And got to see some action in the playoffs. So we'll hope that Hansen returns for the next game. But if not, at least we know there's somebody ready to help out.
When there are multiple officials on standby for a game, how do they decide? Do they do like shoot odds and evens? Is that how they decide who goes out onto the ice?
Look, officially, we have one ref and one lines person. So you're going to fill in for whoever needs to go out there. And I'm saying officially because we know that there are plenty of situations when you do have another official in attendance, or you might have somebody else maybe up in the press box, maybe watching the game. We've seen unlisted standby officials show up in a game because they just happen to be there. So I think in that case, you're going to defer to the guy who's printed on the paper. But outside of that, rock, paper, scissors, it is.
There you go. Figure it out. Okay. A couple of in-game on-ice situations to dive into next. Trevor Moore of the Los Angeles Kings delivered a low hit on Vincent Desharnais of the Edmonton Oilers. He got himself a two-minute minor tripping penalty. I looked at this a few different times, and I thought, you know, maybe there's something that could have been a little more here. It could have been a clipping penalty. Maybe it was a dirty play, I thought. Maybe a fine, maybe some sort of verbal admonishing from player safety, but it just seemed like more than a two-minute penalty.
Yeah, I thought so too, just because it's dangerous, right? You don't want to take a guy's knees out. Those are the types of plays that end seasons or even end careers. So I thought it was a dangerous hit. Look, I'm not going to fault the officials in the game. I agree. I think you nailed it with clipping. Clippings under Rule 44, the act of throwing the body below the knees of an opponent from any direction, and you may not do that. An illegal low hit is a check delivered by a player who may or may not have both skates on the ice with his sole intent to check the opponent in the area of his knees. A player may not lower his body position to deliver a check to an opponent's knees. It's a minor penalty. So you get a minor penalty for clipping. If there's an injury, it jumps to a major. If it's a deliberate intent to injure, then you go to a match penalty. So really, if you want to call it a trip or a clip, I think I can live with them assessing it as a minor penalty. I did think it was a very dangerous play. So that's where I'm not going to throw the officials under the bus. But I think, Todd, whether it's a conversation or in this case, I think it should have been a fine. I would have liked to have seen player safety come out and just issue a fine for clipping to say, yeah, it may have been a minor penalty for a clip, but this type of play is a dangerous one. These are the types of penalties that we don't want to see guys take because of the injury and the dangerous nature of it. To me, this was an easy call to issue a fine just to send that message. But a minor penalty I can live with in the game. I think player safety, with the luxury of additional reviews, additional angles, time to look at it, I think I would have preferred them at least coming back with something. And again, yeah, not suspension worthy, but let's hit the fine.
A little, we see what you did there is, yeah, all we're looking for. Rangers and Capitals game, there was another hit that certainly got an awful lot of attention and spurred a lot of chatter on social media. It was delivered by Artemi Panarin on the Capitals' TJ Oshie. There's a big scrum, of course. The officials, I think, did the right thing. They called a major penalty, which opens it up for review. They had a look at it and decided, you know what? There was no offense committed here. The Caps wound up getting a minor penalty. New York got the man advantage, which, of course, further outraged Ranger fans. But I think this was absolutely the right call. I'm watching it as that's not a penalty. But they handled it the right way, look at it, and make the call official.
Right. And I think, Todd, you nailed it that it's the review process. But to have that review process at all, you have to call the major penalty. If they call it a minor, they can't take a second look at it. If the ref thinks it's a minor and the linesman think it's a major penalty, he reports it to the referee. They can change their call on the ice. They can then make it a major penalty and then go for review. So I think it was the right call. I think it looked like one of those hits that you want a second look at. And whether they legitimately thought it was a major penalty, I can't argue with that watching it real time. But I think after review, you see that there was head contact on the play. Like the NHL rulebook says, there is a rule for an illegal check to the head, which means there is such a thing as a legal check to the head or legal head contact. And the NHL is pretty clear. They've changed this rule a few times over the years to be, is the head the principal point of contact or the primary or the main? Is it the main point of contact? There was absolutely head contact. But when you look at Panarin colliding with Oshie, it's not just the head. He's not picking the head. He's extending his lower body, and Panarin's hip looks like it hits Oshie's midsection. Oshie's head hits Panarin's back. It doesn't hit his elbow. It's not an extended shoulder. So to me, there's head contact. Is the hit avoidable? Perhaps. Does Oshie's body position as he's leaning forward a little bit, does that contribute? probably to a certain extent, his head was lower than it would have been if he were skating upright. Now, he's allowed to do that. He didn't change his body position just prior to the hit. So you factor all these things in, and that's what player safety does. And that's what the NHL officials are doing. They're looking at all the criteria around a legal check to the head. And I'll just stop there, Todd, to say this wasn't a charge. He doesn't leave his skates. He's not jumping off the ice. Right. Clearly not boarding, clearly not interference. So when you're looking at which rules this falls under, you've got to apply the illegal check to the head criteria. They did here. And you know what? If they went with a minor, I think a minor would have been tolerable because there was head contact. So you're making that judgment call on, was it avoidable? Could Panarin have pulled up? Was Oshie already crouched down? But I don't think it's anything more than that simply because of the contact from the rest of the body. So I can live with the no penalty call on the play. Obviously, player safety agreed. They didn't issue a fine. They didn't issue a suspension. There was no hearing on it. So I think I'm okay with the call. I could have gone with a minor penalty. I don't think it's a major. It's definitely not a match penalty. It was scary. You don't want a guy with a history of concussions to have a head injury. But again, you're not looking at the outcome or the injury. You're looking at the act. Is this a suspendable offense? Was this act one where he targeted the head? And I don't think he did.
No, not at all. It was a hard check, and he was trying to deliver it through the torso, through the body.
One other thing, Todd.
Yeah,
I do want to mention, because some folks were really annoyed with this. You mentioned that the Rangers get the one power play coming out of this, that Connor McMichael gets a minor penalty for roughing because mm-hmm. all the guys came together. We had a scrum afterwards. That was not via video review. They can't call the penalty via review. That was not something that they looked at the hit and said, you know what, when we're done with this, we're going to tack on two to McMichael. They had to make that call on the ice prior to any video review because that's not eligible for review. You can't call a penalty on review. You can't use one review for the Panarin headshot and look to see if there's anything else. So that penalty was called on the ice. Just because they didn't announce it at the time they announced the review for the Panarin play doesn't mean they weren't calling it. So for folks that were a little fired up of a penalty coming out at the end, it was called. They called it up front, but then they just needed to sort out the review before they could announce what the penalty calls were. So I know, you know, when we get to announcements and what the officials say, I would have greatly preferred Wes McCauley getting on the mic and saying, right now we've got 2 minutes to McMichael for roughing and a potential major penalty to Panarin. We're going to take a look at that major penalty. It would have cleared things up, and that was what the call was before they went to review. But when you hear it after video review, I think some folks got confused that the McMichael penalty came from review. The review was purely around the Panarin hit.
Thank you for clearing up that conspiracy. Okay, same game. There was a too many men on the ice penalty assessed to the Rangers, and you had a social post about this. You don't necessarily have to touch or play the puck for a too many men on the ice penalty to be called.
You don't, but you have to influence the play. And this one, to me, was a close one. Again, we have the benefit of review. We have the benefit of looking at it 100 times. We can see what's happening with the guys on the ice. But when you're looking at a too many men on the ice penalty, and you have guys coming on the ice or leaving the ice, you get that 5-foot window typically. You can be within 5 feet of the bench. Guy coming on is allowed to be there. Guy leaving is allowed to be there, as long as you don't touch the puck. But it's more than just that. Under Rule 74-1, the player entering the game or the player retiring cannot play the puck. They cannot check or make any physical contact with an opposing player while both players involved in the substitution are on the ice. So that's what the rule says. I get it. We've seen it happen before. We've seen where a player maybe goes to play the puck or positions himself where he's going to influence an opposing player. If you step into somebody's lane and that player has to move, you're influencing the play. The Rangers really tried to put the brakes on here. I'm going to give these guys credit, and I don't remember which players it was hopping on and hopping off, but the player coming on hops on the ice, realizes the puck is coming towards him, and stops. He doesn't leave the boards. His skates are on the ice, but he's back up against the bench. The puck comes by him. He does not make a play on the puck. He doesn't even attempt to make a play on the puck. The player changing is far removed. He's going off the ice. I feel like this is one of those plays where if they had a chance to look at it again, or if you really wanted to go by the rule book, the Rangers were on the legal side of things because they didn't influence the play. They didn't touch the puck. They didn't make a Capitals player do anything different, right? They were just bystanders as play went on. Neither one of them did anything to affect the play. So I could have seen this one getting allowed to slide. They were within the bench. They didn't fall afoul of the rule. I'm going to go back to what I said earlier, though. I don't want to throw the officials under the bus. You've got refs and linesmen, and this penalty can be called by any of the four on the ice. You've got the puck going right towards the Rangers player. he's on the ice. The player changing is still on the ice. You blow the whistle. It's too many men. I think we've seen it happen before. We can live with it. That's how the rule is typically interpreted. And we see that happen. But wow, this was a close one. The Rangers really tried to avoid it. And I thought they almost did.
Yeah, I agree. They tried. But I also think that there were a lot of guys on the ice and it was a bit disruptive to the play. So I would have.
And that's enough. It's a good point. You're disruptive to the play. It's enough. And maybe the presence of them there did change things a little bit. So if I want to go by the letter of the rule book, maybe it gets a little sketchy. But interpretation, judgment, was there an impact? There probably was.
There was another game involving the two Florida teams, Tampa and Florida game number one. It was about 11 and a half minutes left in the third period. There were clearly too many Tampa Bay Lightning players on the ice. I learned to count to five pretty early, but apparently these guys didn't.
So, look, we're talking nuances. We're talking the Rangers, where their skates are and where their sticks are and what does it look like they're doing. Then Tampa just blows the whole thing out of the water with seven guys out there. I mean, you can't not call this one. And again, look, even if you're not touching the puck or affecting an opposing player, when you have two extra skaters out there, there's no question your opponent is doing something different than they would if you had the proper number of skaters out there. So, yeah, any nuance, any dispute, anything like that, blown out of the water here. The Lightning were on a man advantage for sure, and they got caught for it.
Yeah. That was an easy call to make. Okay, another one involving the Canes and the Islanders matchup. Goaltender Ilya Sorokin loses his bucket and the whistle blows. However, let's use this as a reminder and refresher, if you will. It is not that the officials are immediately required to blow the whistle if a goaltender loses his mask.
It's not. It is not, despite what folks think or what they would like to see. It's not an automatic whistle when the mask comes off. It really depends on the situation. And yes, this means that you could have a goalie facing a slap shot with no helmet on. It's just the way the rule is written and the way the NHL is comfortable with the infrequency of these situations that rule 9.6 is when a goaltender has lost his helmet and his team has control of the puck, we can stop play immediately. When the opposing team has control of the puck, it's a little bit different. They can only blow the whistle if there is no immediate and impending scoring opportunity. They want to let the opposing team finish their shot. You can't have a goalie shaking their mask off. And yes, sometimes a goalie loses their mask on their own. Obviously, it's a penalty if they take it off themselves. Even if a strap's broken, even if things have come loose, if a goaltender shakes off his mask, he's considered removing his mask, and that does draw a penalty. But we still don't blow the whistle until his team or he gets control of the puck, because we can't allow a scoring opportunity to be lost because of the goaltender's mask. I know it feels sometimes, Todd, barbaric when the goalie loses his mask and somebody's putting a shot out to the point and you see a blast come in from the blue line. It feels frightening that you would want goalies to be unprotected, to be putting themselves in danger in those types of situations. But the way the NHL rulebook currently reads, you're allowed to keep playing when the goalie doesn't have his mask. It is not an automatic stoppage in play.
Play to the whistle. All right. Now, it wouldn't be the Stanley Cup playoffs if we weren't talking about the Boston Bruins and more specifically Brad Marchand. So he and Tyler Bertuzzi of the Toronto Maple Leafs have been going at it through their series. And in game number two, Tyler Bertuzzi got a penalty for a slash on the Bruins winger. And you know what? He earned it. He was a slash. The funny part, as we'll see, is that after Bertuzzi hits Marchand, he goes down and he's trying to sell it a little bit, of course, except he is grabbing his left leg in pain, whereas Bertuzzi slashed him on the right leg. I just found this kind of amusing and wanted to see it again.
You know, I didn't catch it the first time. I obviously saw the whack and it looked like a penalty for Bertuzzi, and that's fine. I mean, no matter whether it was a severe injury or not, I'm okay with the slash getting a call. We had a few other slashes happen, or even some spears that have taken place over the past week that maybe went uncalled. So I'm always in favor of anything that's an intentional shot to a lightly protected place or a weak part of the body. Let's call it. So Bertuzzi earned his 2 minutes, but Marchand, man, is selling that thing like a late night infomercial and just grabbing the entire wrong leg. Look, he's done it enough. He's gotten under enough team skin, and you would think the guy's a pro at it, right? We even have opposing coaches calling him out for being amazing at this. But you got to get the leg right, man. And I don't know if he's been warned this season, but I was hoping that NHL Hockey Ops caught that one, because a $2,000 fine for diving embellishment sure feels appropriate right about now.
Yeah, I can see how that would be that would be appropriate. Okay, now let's get to the craziest play of the early going. I don't want to say it will definitely be the craziest play of the entire Stanley Cup playoffs, but it's certainly got a chance. Happens in the Colorado-Winnipeg game. Adam Lowry of the Jets fires a shot towards the net. It hits the post. It goes across the goal line, flipping around, hits the post, and comes back across the goal line again and hits one more post and then dribbles away. Lowry thought immediately that he had scored. I saw it and thought, I don't know about this. I saw a couple replays. It didn't look like we were going to be able to tell. But there was a replay that did show the puck had completely crossed the line. But I was a little worried about this one, that we could end up as maybe we could talk about puck tracking one more time.
Oh, puck tracking or any other solution to know whether or not the puck has crossed the line. Flashback to a Calgary-Tampa Stanley Cup final there. Is it in? Is it not in? Is it parallax angle? Is it a crazy view of the camera? I was with you, Todd. In real time, I said, oh, that's in. And then you see the puck come out and you start thinking of the physics of, well, how could that possibly be possible? How can it hit both posts, hit a third post, and have not crossed the line? Or if it crossed the line, how did it come back and hit the post? I mean, we're not throwing curveballs or sinkers out there. So I think the overhead view showed it. I love the announcers saying that Lowry saw that it was in, so he's celebrating, so it must be a goal. Because, of course, the player shooting the puck has the best uncontestable view of the play.
No bias there.
But this was, it was crazy because the first hit sends the puck right across the crease to the second post. We're all fine there. It's the backspin on the puck that makes this whole play crazy, because as the puck comes off the post, it's got a certain amount of spin. It's going end over end. And if you watch it, you have to look at both angles, right? You have to understand from the overhead, where's the puck? And then you see it from the front to see that it actually goes down, hits the ice. But because it's going end over end, that bounce causes it to then bounce forward and contact the post again. So, man, it was so close. If it stays flat, does it completely cross the line? I don't know, but it doesn't have to do that. When it's end over end, we're only looking for the puck to completely cross the line. This is one of the challenges of puck tracking, because unlike a soccer ball or a tennis ball, we don't have a sphere. It's not the same all the time. In this case, the puck was on edge when it was ruled to have completely crossed the line. So you've got to take all of that into consideration. Thankfully, the crossbar camera was available. They did have the cameras in the crossbars for this game that we were able to see the angle of the puck completely over the line. So I think the review was pretty quick on this one. I'm glad that it was. I'm glad it wasn't controversial, but it made for a lot of fun in the moment of wondering, how exactly did the puck do that?
And we may not ever know, but the great part is we're still early in the Stanley Cup playoffs. And as the great Bob Cole would say, everything is happening.
Good stuff, man. Way to work.
Get in the box. It's the Scouting the Refs podcast. Read more at scoutingtherefs.com. Follow Scouting the Refs on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Email the show at heyref@scoutingtherefs.com.
You're good, my book.
Subscribe, share, and keep those sticks down.
That's good play.